from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Chris Loffrey, and you're listening to the In the Moment Arts Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state of South Dakota. Listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or ask your smart speaker to play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to our segments podcast. Here's your weekly roundup in arts coverage. Senior point guard for the Pine Ridge Thorps, Charles Schrader Jr. had a lot of challenges throughout his high school career. Before his freshman season, his brother was shot and killed outside of the recreation center in Pine Ridge. Soon after, he sustained a rare knee injury. Beyond all of that, Charles is still one of the best basketball players in South Dakota. This week, SDPB's Nate Weck joined In the Moment host Lori Walsh to tell us Charles' story of endurance, grit, and achievement.
Hey, Nate, welcome.
Hey, Lori, how are you going today?
It's going great. Tell me about Charles Schrader Jr.
Yeah, he's a point guard from Pine Ridge. And yeah, like you said in your intro there, he is one of the best basketball players in the state. And I'm sure there's a lot of listeners right now that are saying, oh, I don't really know who he is. Yeah. But the exposure maybe hasn't been there for him, as you sometimes see, especially in the Rapid City community and Sioux Falls with the media outlets and stuff like that. You know, growing up on the Pine Ridge Reservation, sometimes there's not as much coverage from media about athletics and stuff like that. But, you know, all that aside, Charles Schrader Jr. is still one of the better basketball players in the state. He's a senior. And yeah, so we decided, why not take a trip and tell his story. So we went to Pine Ridge last week and had a chance to sit down with him, his family, and just spend the day kind of with him. And they had a game that night against St. Francis Indian School. So we stuck around for that as well. And yeah, so one of the questions, you know, just kind of jump right into it and then we'll kind of get into his story. But one of the questions that we wanted to ask him right away was, you know, Charles, what does basketball mean to you? And here's what Charles had to say.
Basketball to me is my life. It's been there for me ever since I was a little kid. Any trouble I went through, I turned to basketball, and it's just been there for me my whole life. I honestly don't know where I would be right now without basketball.
So Charles has had quite the life, especially in his throughout his high school career. As a freshman, his brother Vincent, or Vinny is what they call him, was actually killed right outside the Sioux Ann Big Crow Recreation Center right there in Pine Ridge. So he's just about to start his, you know, his freshman year, and he's, you know, he's in school at this time, getting ready to play basketball. And in October of his fall freshman year, his brother is killed.
This devastating loss.
Devastated. Yep, exactly. And, you know, he was very open to us when we were there talking about it, but he said that it was really one of those things that, you know, he just kind of went into shock, you know, for, you know, 2-3 weeks right after it happened, and it kind of took him some time. But he did discuss with us about how basketball saved him, and, you know, after his brother's death, how basketball kind of came to the rescue for him.
Just basketball. I know he passed away like a month before basketball season, so it was like really hard for me to find the love for the game. But I realized, like, every time I was at home, I was alone and I was depressed. But every time I come to the gym, all that would go away. And that's when I really turned to basketball, is when my brother passed away. Because it bring light to my family when they was down. And it really helped bring my family up from my brother's passing.
His mom said that too, that, you know, it wasn't necessarily a distraction that of Charles playing basketball, but him playing at a high level, because his brother Vinny was a very good basketball player too. So for Charles to kind of come in and have the opportunity to start as a freshman for Pine Ridge, which is a pretty big basketball school here in the state of South Dakota, to be able to come in as a freshman and to start and actually have success kind of lifted the spirits in a time where the spirits could not have been any lower for his family.
So is Vinny older than Charles?
Yes, Vinny was older. I think he was born in 1983, so he would have been, 3 years ago. So he would have been, you know, he would have been in his late 20s at the time of his passing. So he gets done with his freshman season, and, you know, he's starting to feel better about himself, getting ready to go into his sophomore year. There was a practice or... It was either a practice or kind of a shoot-around type of thing. And he went up for a dunk because he was just learning to touch the rim and, you know, starting to figure out dunking. And what a, you know, that's a cool moment for like any high school kid. I'm sure a lot of basketball players in the state right now, if they're listening, can relate to the first time you touch the rim and try dunking. So he kind of came down and thought he landed on a basketball, but it turns out it wasn't a basketball. His knee just kind of made like a weird popping noise. And it wasn't an ACL tear, but, and I had to write it down because I'm never, you know, I'd never remember this, but an avulsion of the patella tendon. And basically it's a complex, very rare knee injury that ended his sophomore season. And his mom spoke about this too, about how devastating that was for him and trying to keep his spirits up because, and he even told us too, I didn't really let out, you know, my true pain when my brother died. Once I had to be sidelined for the basketball season, it's like all my emotions then just kind of came out. So, you know, picture that, you know, his entire sophomore season not being able to play basketball, you know, something that has helped him cope with, you know, with the passing of his brother, which, you know, only happened a year prior to this, so it's still very fresh in his mind. So he had to take a sophomore season off, but it does get happier, I promise.
I'm starting to cry.
So as a junior, which was just last year, Pine Ridge had one of their best seasons in recent history. They went to the State A basketball tournament, lost in the semifinal round to T, which T going into the state tournament was a conversation point around the state because even though they were in Class A, there was people, you know, media analysts, you know, myself even was involved in a couple conversations of maybe is T really the best in the state, the best boys basketball team in the state? I think we had a conversation about that too, Lori. So Pine Ridge comes in their semifinal night. Everybody's just thinking T's just going to walk the floor with them. And Pine Ridge is there. You know, every punch that gets thrown, they're throwing a punch right back. And it's just that way. It was one of the best basketball games that I've seen in my time here over the last 5 years working for SDPB. It was just one of those because you didn't know what was going to happen. Yeah. And the final score is 57-51. But even, you know, 6 points is a close game. Yeah. But it was even closer than that. You know, it comes down to the free throws at the end. And that's really what separated it. But it was from start to finish. It was just a fantastic basketball game. And Pine Ridge gave T all they could handle and them some. And yeah, it was fantastic to watch. And, you know, we did talk to them about this as well. And, you know, it was, they were a little still bummed that, you know, that happened last year because they saw that they, you know, they had bigger goals, obviously, than for themselves. I look at it and I saw, you know, a Cinderella story almost come true and it was great. Now, you know, fast forward to this year, Charles is a senior and, you know, he's living up the moment and all that type of stuff. His coach, Casey Means, of the boys' coach, also had some nice words to say about him. And he does get a little emotional, but Coach Casey Means talks about admiring his star senior point guard.
I'm proud of Charles from what he has overcame, how he goes out about his daily life, how he carries others, how he's humble and respectful. He's an old ways. He reminds me of an old grandpa, like from the 1800s. He's respectful, watches his elders, carries himself in a good way. Don't talk about others, you know. I love him like a son, not much.
Powerful words there.
Yeah. Well, grief is forever. I mean, there's another challenge coming, you know, when you graduate and you know, what happens after high school basketball for, you know, a kid like Charles Schrader and what does he do next? Because that grief comes back to bite you and it's a lot to process especially at such a young age.
It is. Yeah. I mean, this is a kid that since the age of 14 has had some insane hurdles that even a person in their 30s would struggle with. So to be able to kind of hone this in and be so mature as he has been through this is really remarkable, really. Yeah. I mean, he's a hero in other ways besides just, you know, being pretty good on the basketball court. Right. So,
which he
is. Yes, he's a very, if you ever get the opportunity to, if Pine Ridge is coming close to you or if you're out in the area and you have some free time some night to get down there and watch him, I mean, he's a great kid and Pine Ridge is, you know, it's a good basketball school. So you're going to see more than just him as a good player. But yeah, it's one of those things. And, you know, what's next for him? he doesn't really know at this point, but yeah. he hopes basketball is for sure in his future. He just hasn't quite decided yet. Yeah. And, you know, he's also pretty good in school with his grades, almost a straight A student. So yeah. He's also looking at what am I going to do? Maybe business. He also talked about maybe his dream of opening a YMCA center someday in Pine Ridge. Right. So, you know, we'll just have to wait and see what the future holds for Charles Schrader Jr.
We will keep our eyes out and keep cheering him on from the court and beyond. And a great story again, Nate Weck, about, you know, the power of athletics off, you know, when the game's over. It still matters. Thank you for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Lori.
Visitors from all over the globe still run the rolling hills of one of South Dakota's oldest visitor attractions, Dinosaur Park. For this week's Images of the Past, we looked at how those dinosaurs found a home on a ridge of sandstone in western South Dakota. In the Moment, host Lori Walsh was joined by Troy Kilpatrick, executive director at the Journey Museum and Learning Center, along with Pat Roseland with the Minnelusa Historical Association.
All right, let's talk about those dinosaurs because, you know, if you grew up around here, you might not know where how far back they go. Tell us a story from the idea of this and how it got started.
Well, my interest was finding out who done them initially and constructed the dinosaurs. And in my research, I found out Emma Sullivan was basically practicing as a lawyer here in Rapid City and also did little plaster castings of Native American bust and plaques, and he was chosen to do the dinosaurs, and he basically said he could do a large-sized dinosaur compared to what he was doing in the past, and that's how he started.
Just found some lawyer who could do small things and said, can you do them big?
And he agreed to it.
How big do you want them?
How big do you want them? And do we have an idea of, like, who, you know, who conceived it, who reached out to Emmett Sullivan and said, this is, because this is one of the earliest sort of visitor attractions in the state.
Well, it's initially members of the Chamber of Commerce got interested. Cece O'Hara, who was president of the South Dakota School of Mines at that point, was interested, and he is basically a well-known authority on paleontology at that time, and a few other leaders of Rapid City got involved in that also.
So, kind of hard to imagine that someone who was the president of the School of Mines would put their fingerprints all over some dinosaurs, right?
Perfect. And, you know, we said that Emmett was a lawyer, but he's also an artist. What do we know about his training or his sort of credentials as a sculptor?
Well, from my thought, it was all basically self-taught. He basically started out with smaller, like I said, doing little dinosaurs, little plaques on about Native American chiefs and Indian princesses, and he always had, these were done from live cast rather than just doing it from mind. And he basically, at that point, once he got the dinosaur park done, he also had the concession there and sold all his little treasures that he had built along the way. Hmm. And also he did the plaster casts of dinosaurs to take to Washington, D.C. to get the money from Congress to get this project done. Hmm. And there's five plaster castings of those dinosaurs. And they're basically dated between 1936 and 1937.
Wow. All right, so we're talking, there's also some influence in the government and the Works Progress Administration. Troy, what can you tell us about that connection?
Well, you know, it's interesting that there's so many iconic things that were built during that time with the Civilian Conservation Corps, and these all kind of fall hand-in-hand in there. And I know one of the things that Pat shared when he did the Turtle Soup program at the Journey Museum was just some of the connections, and then even Mr. Sullivan's prior experiences too, because I know that Pat was illustrating, he was a lawyer, but he's actually got a kind of an impressive resume. But all these projects were funded to kind of enhance communities and create create jobs and create ways to be proud of stuff. And I think here we are today, we're still looking up on the hill. And Pat and I were joking, you know, I was referring to it as a brontosaurus. I guess I've learned today it's an apatosaurus, Lori. I've been falsely identifying this dinosaur forever on the skyline of Rapid City. But we've created something that people look at every day now from in the 30s. That's an image of Rapid City, and it's really cool. But I'd love for Pat to talk a little bit more about Emmett's background, because, I mean, it's more than just a lawyer. I mean, it's really impressive.
Yeah, go ahead, Pat.
Well, he was also involved after the Dinosaur Park in two different projects in Arkansas, Christ on the Mountain, and then Dinosaur World there. And that's how he got involved in those. But he basically constructed the five dinosaurs, the Apatosaurus, Triceratops, Stegosaurus, Trachodon, and Tyrannosaurus Rex. And I think he's always was interested in doing plaster sculptures of different ideas and figures in the animal world. And somehow he jumped from the little miniature ones up to 90 or 100-foot dinosaurs on Dinosaur Hill.
Not necessarily an easy, you know, we think about just all that goes into the structure of that those are still standing.
He was pretty proud of himself. Yeah. He knew he could do it, and I'm sure he didn't realize it lasted for 83 years. But
yeah. how did he choose which dinosaurs to make the connection between the history of the Black Hills and, you know, obviously these are representations that are, you know, not, you know, we know more now about what dinosaurs perhaps looked like than he did then. But why those ones? Why Apatosaurus?
These are the dinosaurs that roamed the Black Hills 150 million years ago. And so he did the five large ones that were basically part of the Black Hills history in the Jurassic times. Then later on, he did two other smaller ones up near the concession stand. One was a Dimetrodon, and the other one was a dinosaur that didn't Proceratops, that was the only dinosaur that did not roam the hills during the dinosaur time. So he had a total of seven dinosaurs up here, and they, for the most part, they all roamed the Black Hills back in the old days.
Tell us a little bit about how much the project cost, or and how long it took. What was he paid?
Basically, he was given 15 months to create the project with a budget of $25,000. And he started the project in March of 1936, and then the dedication was basically done in June of 1937. So it was like a little over 13 months he got the project done. Took 3 months to paint the dinosaurs, so that was a big part of it also. And he basically did a lot of research on how the colors and that sort of thing to paint the dinosaurs in the correct way.
Yeah. Tell
That's pretty quick. That's a pretty good turnaround.
It's under his deadline. I mean, really, right?
Yeah, anytime you're done before workers. Your deadline, you're good. Right?
But not all is well in their relationship between WPA and Emmett. Tell us a little bit about those teeth.
Well, towards the end of the project, they had a little falling out on, I guess, how the project was going to end. And so Emmett Sullivan resigned from the project, and he took the Tyrannosaurus Rex teeth with him, basically, because he said that he did those on his own time and he wasn't going to put them in there until things got straightened out. And then later on, when they started seeing eye to eye, Emmett Sullivan put the teeth back where they should be in the Tyrannosaurus Rex's mouth. And 83 years later, right now, he's toothless again. All the teeth fell out and haven't been replaced again. So
that seems like a very savvy thing to hold back, because T-Rex isn't really T-Rex without his teeth. He knew what he was doing there. Like he couldn't undo the sculpture, but he had some leverage.
The ultimate leverage.
Right?
A T-Rex that's going to gum you, right?
Right. And, you know, tell us a little bit about efforts. Is there a time capsule? Is there, you know, sort of interpretation? How do we commemorate those people that had this idea 83 years ago?
Yeah, there's a record of the project with the names and supporters of that project, the officials of WPA, the Rapid City Chamber of Commerce, and other leaders of Rapid City were put in like a little plastic packet, sealed packet, placed in the thigh of the Patasaurus. And it's basically, it said in the research, where it's expected to remain until exposed by the elements in the far distant future. So far that the far distant future hasn't arrived yet, and it's still in a good, safe home.
All right, a little bit about Dinosaur Park, and I was looking up online for some better visuals and found this video of families just running all over that, kids just burning off energy and squealing with delight at the next dinosaur that they saw. You just couldn't, there was such joy. This is a project that has brought joy to so many families and has become iconic in its own way, isn't it?
Yeah, and also it comes with the School of Mines. They put up, dress them up every year.
Oh, I didn't know that.
ribbons around the Patasaurus's neck and that sort of thing. And
he's helped celebrate Red Ribbon Week, you know, a little awareness there. And they've been a banner for the school during, he'll wear an M on his belly sometimes for homecoming and things. So they make it all better when it's done, but... It is fun to watch it take on those different personalities, too.
Right. And it also asks, begs the question then, why were they here and what do we know about the history of this place as well in a deep, thoughtful way, and also just a lot of joy and fun because everybody loves a good dinosaur.
I think after all these years, Dinosaur Park is still an integral part of Rapid City.
Yeah.
People love it, and the dinosaurs at this point, they've been here for 83 years, and they have the best view of Rapid City than anybody else has in Rapid City.
The things they have seen.
Right.
Troy and Pat, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having us, Lori.
Christine Stewart is Poet Laureate for the state of South Dakota. She's inviting poets with deep connections to the state to submit work for an upcoming anthology. She sat down with In the Moment host Lori Walsh to discuss the upcoming collection.
Welcome back, Christine. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
I am doing well, and you are well into your Poet Laureate tenure here, and I remember when we first talked to you about what your plans were. An anthology was very much in the front of your mind back then. Tell us a little bit about how this idea was born.
Well, because I love to put poems together in my own collections, I thought it would be a great idea to put poems of South Dakotans together in an anthology. And after I started doing some research, I learned that had been a thing in South Dakota's history for decades. All throughout the 20th century, every decade or so, someone would put an anthology of prairie poets together or think some other title such as that. Usually people associated with the South Dakota State Poetry Society are a grassroots organization that's been around for nearly 100 years, mm-hmm. about 90 or so years. But we hadn't had anything like that lately. Patrick Hicks did an anthology, Harvest of Words, in 2010, and he selected a dozen or so South Dakota poets who already had a book or two out to submit poems to him. But I thought I would take a different way to do it and do an open call to anyone writing in South Dakota or who had lived here for a while, who had something to say about our culture, our landscapes, our people here, mm-hmm. history, and see what comes over the transom that way.
And when you look back at some of those historic anthologies, do you notice well-known people? Do you notice certain themes about what we have a tendency to say about our state historically?
We like to talk about the weather. That doesn't seem to change from decade to decade. lots of wind and snow and beauty, absolutely.
Right.
But definitely lots of landscape.
Okay, so talk about that a little bit as a poet in your own work. When something is so compelling and impacts people's lives so much, it almost has to be expressed poetically. It almost has to be dealt with. It's so much a part of our character. How do you deal with weather in your own work?
Well, I noticed that before I moved to South Dakota in 2007, I had a lot of nature images in my work, but not as much like storms and snow and just this way that weather shapes our decisions and the places we choose to live and how we choose to live close to the places we need to be or not. Or I mean, it just really shapes the way we shop and the way we dress.
Right.
I mean, all sorts of things, you know, I mean, just the day to day. And I think I took that for granted in the places I had lived before. So I definitely see that as being something that people talk about in their work. But they also tend to see beauty in that. You know, there's beauty in the snow, just like there's beauty in the prairie and in sunsets and all those sorts of things. So there's these constraints of the weather, but we shape them into something interesting and beautiful. So that's always hopeful.
Tell us a little bit about the timeline for the open call and how people, you know, what exactly are you looking for from whom?
Well, the deadline is March 1st, and so I'm hoping that we get some more submissions before then. I'm looking for poems by anyone. Doesn't matter if you've published poems before. Hopefully we'll see some quality writing, and that doesn't have to be formal quality, just different, like lots of good imagery, maybe some attention to craft that way. I'm hoping to see poems from people in the cities, not just people in the rural areas. I've already seen a lot of great poems from rural areas, but you know, we have some urban areas in our state too, so I'm hoping to see some of those poems from youth. So I'd like to see some more poems from middle school, high schoolers, and I definitely want to see some from a variety of cultural perspectives. You know, I kind of take it for granted in my discipline in creative writing that we tend to critique that which we love the most, what we see as having the most amazing potential. And sometimes I see that same with the state. So I want this anthology to be a celebration of what we have here, but also with a healthy dose of reality. And there can be some critique in there, because we wouldn't critique what we don't love and we don't want to make better.
Right.
So there can be a variety of places from which people speak about our state.
And do you think that can be a challenge for writers of all kinds from South Dakota, that there is almost an expectation if you leave South Dakota that you have an opportunity to critique it thoughtfully? But if you're here, because so many people from other places have negative things to say, that you know, you feel like I got to carry the flag a little bit and make sure people know. So do you see that that's a challenge for South Dakota authors in a way that maybe it wouldn't be in New York City, for example?
Yeah, I see that we want to show the breadth that we have here. And so, yeah, sometimes I think that we don't want to launch those critiques, but I think that's important to balance out our own work as a writer. I know that sometimes even a praise poem has to have a little bit of shadow in it to have that sort of tension and that tightness and that so whatness. Mm-hmm. And so I see that any book or any anthology is kind of an extension of that small poem that has to have some sort of tension in it in order for us to care, in order for us to see that tension, that conflict. And so I don't think all the poems have to have that in there, but as that's one of my jobs as the editor is to make sure that I have this breadth and this like holistic view that the book speaks to as a whole.
And when do you hope that the book will be in readers' hands?
I'm hoping for fall.
Yeah. Hoping for the South Dakota Festival of Books. That time frame,
yeah,
what a great time
of course.
To launch. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Of course that all depends on a lot of things coming together. But yeah, I think South Dakotans can show up with some really amazing poetry submissions. How do people submit, where they send their work?
So I'm taking submissions online versus on a submittable. So it's sdsps.submittable.com/submit. And you can also find information at sdpoetry.org, which is the South Dakota State Poetry Society's website. We have, that's also how we get submissions for our for Pasque Petals, the literary journal that we publish. So if you just follow those links there, it might take a couple links, clicks on the links, but you'll find it. And it's free to submit. Just online is just easier way for us to keep track of the submissions and make sure we get is 1 to 2 poems. You can submit your best 1 to 2 poems that you think speaks to South Dakota, and also state your connection to the state. I think that's pretty important to me.
Right. We'll put a link up on our website as well at listen.sdpb.org so people can just click directly to that submittable site too. You mentioned writing attention to craft. And just as a general sort of guideline before we let you go, for people who are trying to become better poets, give us some of that evergreen advice.
Make sure you have a lot of imagery in your poems that you you appeal to sight and sound and touch and taste. And it doesn't matter if it rhymes or not the end, but sound, attention to sound is also good. So to have some alliteration or some rhythms that you integrate into the lines is also a good idea. But really, you know, if you want to write, it just make time for it. It's a discipline, and that's what will make you have better craft over time. It's just sitting down and doing it.
And read some of that poetry as well. Christine That's Stewart, great. Thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate being here.
On Fridays, we feature poetry from Studio 47 with Patrick Hicks. Robert Burns was the spotlight this time around. Let's listen.
This is poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Robert Burns, known affectionately as Robbie Burns and sometimes as the National Bard. He was born on January 25th, 1759, in Alloway, Scotland. His father, William Burns, was a self-taught farm laborer and tried to educate his son as best he could. In need of work, the family moved to Mount Oliphant. The work on this farm was hard, and the money came even harder. It was during this time that Robbie Burns developed a permanent stoop from the, quite literally, back-breaking labor that he was doing as a child. At a local school, he eventually learned Latin, French, and mathematics. He also learned how to love words and how to read music. These two skills would change his life. In his early 20s, and trying to make a profession for himself, Burns wrote a volume of poetry called Poems Chiefly in the Scottish Dialect. It would become known as Kilmarnock, and it made Burns wildly famous throughout all of Scotland. When he arrived in Edinburgh, for example, he was greeted with enthusiasm, respect, and awe. Here was a writer who embraced not only Scottish stories, but also the Scottish dialect. He gained some financial independence because of this and bought a farm just outside of Dumfries. He quickly gave up farming, though, to write full-time. He wrote many poems and essays over his lifetime, including A Red, Red Rose, Tam O'Shanter, Poems and Songs, and Auld Lang Syne, which I suspect is something you sing, or attempt to sing, every New Year's Eve when the clock strikes midnight. That song, you see, is in the Scottish dialect. Auld Lang Syne means old long since, or, put another way, in times gone by. Because of his love of music, Burns also collected lyrics and folk songs that were in danger of being forgotten. He was known for his outspoken political beliefs, not least of which his support of the American Revolution. For the Scottish, he quickly became a national hero and icon. In failing health, he passed away on July 21st, 1796, in Dumfries. He was 37 years old. Our poem for today is called Address to a Haggis. This particular poem is recited for something called Burns Night that takes place every January 25th. This, of course, is the birthday of Robbie Burns. All across Scotland, and indeed all across the world, people gather for a large dinner where glasses of whiskey are raised, and the work of this poet is recited with gusto. I have to admit, it's a lot of fun. This usually takes place in a large hall. A host welcomes everyone to the feast. Grace is said in the Scottish dialect, and then a large haggis is marched in, usually with bagpipes blaring. After the haggis is presented, the host ceremoniously cuts it with a sword or dagger, and then recites, from memory, Robbie Burns's poem, Address to a Haggis. At this point in the show, I would normally read that poem for you. However, today, we have a very special guest who will be doing that for us. I'm delighted to introduce Mr. Brian Shaw, who will recite Address to a Haggis in the Scottish dialect. Brian, welcome to Poetry from Studio 47. I know you've been involved with Burns Night celebrations for many years. Could you tell us a bit more about haggis, what it is, and why it's important?
Thanks for having me on the show, Patrick. Let's talk about Burns Night. Burns Night are celebrated around the world, not only by large groups in large halls, but sometimes in a small setting as someone's parlor or living room where there may be 4 to 6 people. They'll same have the traditional dinner, the traditional settings, and read poems and maybe even sing a few songs depending on how many drams of whiskey they've had. Burns and haggis go together because Burns elevated the haggis to a higher level because he sometimes said, when that's all you've got, it's really important. And if you can imagine, long before refrigeration is when you slaughtered an animal, you kept and used every part. And haggis is traditionally a sheep's stomach, stuffed with whatever you may have on hand, oatmeal, beef suet, some of the parts that weren't all that pretty when you were butchering an animal. And then you boiled it in the pouch for 4 or 5 hours, and it became quite odoriferous in your abode. And that's why Burns took that and said, it's not a meal, it's sustenance. It's all you've got, so enjoy it and treat it with respect. So what I'd like to do is take his famous poem, Address to a Haggis, and read that for you in the best brogue I can add to some of the embellishments. And if you can picture that you're at a formal dinner enjoying this, usually a cappella, and sit back. Fair fay your honest sonsy face, great chieftain o' the puddin' race, abound the eye, yet take your place, pinch, tripe, or therm. Weel, are you worthy of a grace, as long's my arm. The groanin' trencher there you fill, your hurdy's like a distant hill, your pin would help to mend a mill in time of need. Well, through your pores, the dew distills like amber bead. His knife, see rustic labor dick, and cut you up with ready slight, trenching your gushing entrails bright like ony ditch. And then, oh, what a glorious sight. Warm, reeking, rich. Then horn for horn, they stretch and strive, they take the hindmost underdrive, till all the wee smalt Celts belive are bent like drums. Then old Giedman maced, like the rive, be thank it hums. Is there that or a French ragout, or oleo would start a sow, or fricassee would make her spew with perfect scunner, looks down with sneerful, scornful view on sick a dinner? Poor devil! See him o'er its trash, as feckless as a withered rash, his spindle shank, a gibwit lash, his knave a knit, through bloody flood or field to dash, oh how unfit. But mark the rustic haggis fed, the trembling earth resounds his tread, clapping his wally knave a blade, he'll make it whistle, and legs and arms and heads will sned, like taps of a thistle. Ye powers who make mankind your care, and dish em out your bill of fare. Old Scotland wants nay skink and ware that jumps and luggies. But if you wish her grateful prayer, give her a haggis.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. This episode was recorded at Augustana University and produced by Peter Folliard. Thank you for listening.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwemke, and Josh, I'm Chris Loffrey. Thanks for listening.